The greatest asset to the devotee of God is inner stillness. Stillness does not mean that distractions or disturbances don't arise. But just because a disturbance in the mind arises doesn't mean you've left stillness. Don't waste your time and energy on repetitive, redundant, useless thinking, which is what constitutes 90% of the ego's thought activity. Everything in life is greatly enhanced in the state of silence, because the state of inner silence cultivates the flow state. This practice will do wonders for your ability to cultivate inner stillness, but it's an admittedly challenging practice, and that is now, devotion is inherently, as we've said, kind of a feminine-oriented path, very much like you're in the heart space. And we think of inner stillness as a very masculine quality, and it is. But that's because devotion is not just a purely feminine path. It's a balanced path of masculine and feminine qualities working together to create devotion. It's just that the most outwardly seen and felt aspect of devotion is very feminine, very heart-oriented. But the greatest asset to the devotee of God is inner stillness. And we're going to talk about why today. And I'm going to give you guys, let's say, the three best ways to cultivate inner stillness. And I'm going to actually give you a specific practice for each one of these three ways. So this might be one of those lectures you want to take notes on. So let's dive into it. So let's begin with this statement. Silence is the state of listening to reality. Inner stillness is the state of listening to reality. And so practicing devotion is an exceedingly difficult practice when we don't have inner stillness, or when we have a very noisy mind. Because with a noisy mind, devotion becomes very difficult, because you cannot be a true devotee of God if you're not always listening to God. You know, a devotee is one who's always listening to the master, following the master as a perfect servant would. So we have to be in a state of constant receptivity to the divine presence if we're going to really live a life of devotion. So the question is, well, how do I still a noisy mind? If my mind is full of noisy thoughts and distractions all day, how can I cultivate inner stillness? It seems like a difficult task. And so the three attributes, let's say, that I want to give you guys today, for these are the things you want to be aware of and work towards if you really want to go to that next level of cultivating inner stillness. And that is, number one, attachments and desires, or let's say the quality of detachment. Sometimes it's also called dispassion. Number two is being mindful of repetitive and or useless thinking, or useless thoughts, repetitive thoughts. Cultivating a mindfulness where you're really watching your thought activity and really paying attention to what thoughts that are there that are just not useful in this moment, that are repetitive and redundant, and cultivating mindfulness around that kind of thought activity. That's number two. And then the third quality would be, of course, non-doership. So we're going to break down all three of these and see how they correlate to creating a foundation of deep inner stillness. So silence is the state of listening to reality. Devotion to God is listening to God. Right? You can't be a servant, you can't be a devotee if you're not listening, open, receptive. And so stillness gets a lot of confusing definitions given to it by our ego mind, because ego thinks stillness means no thoughts are appearing, we're not thinking about anything, no distractions are appearing, right? And these are the incorrect definitions that we need to have good rebuttals for. Otherwise, the ego will always drag us back into those the wrong perception, the wrong attitude of what stillness really is. Because stillness, inner silence, is unequivocally not the absence of any distractions. Stillness does not mean that distractions or disturbances don't arise. Now, oftentimes in stillness they don't, but just because a disturbance in the mind arises doesn't mean you've left stillness. And that fact has to be deeply grasped, because then we beat ourselves up. Every time there's a thought, we go, oh, I just can't stay in the stillness. No, no, no. You're not the thinking mind. You're not the noisy monkey mind who's thinking thoughts and is distracted all the time. You are the inner awareness. You are the inner presence, the I am. So you are always still. So stillness is connecting to the I am and abiding as the I am, which is watching, witnessing all activity, mind activity, physical activity, emotional activity. You're just the witness of everything. So stillness means that you can remain in the state of devotion and awareness, even if there are disturbances, right? Stillness means you're not disturbed by the disturbances. Stillness means you're not dragged away by the mind activity. So stillness is the state of the true devotee. Stillness is abiding in the state of union with God. That's all it is. And in the state of oneness with the infinite, there's nothing we can really say to describe or define what that state is like. There's no way that we could ever verbalize or demonstrate to somebody what that state is like through actions. Because no action, no word, no concept can ever describe the state of union, the state of inner stillness. And so that's why the best medium by which we can represent our oneness is through stillness. One who is living still, mindful, quiet, gentle, aware, awake, present, grounded. That's the state of somebody who's in that oneness. And it's their stillness that actually demonstrates their oneness, not their actions. Actions can demonstrate oneness too, but actions should not be our default state and aren't our default state. Our true default state is simple being. I'm just here. So perhaps the most immediately helpful practice for cultivating inner stillness is in the refusing to let any mental impression, any desire, any impression at all to register in your mind for long. Meaning, don't spend a lot of time thinking about anything. Thoughts are useful devices. There's a necessity for thinking, of course. Practical thought is very useful. And thought itself as a creative tool is very useful. So we're not saying don't think ever. Thinking is also divine. But what we're saying is don't waste your time and energy on repetitive, redundant, useless thinking, which is what constitutes 90%, if not 100%, of the ego's thought activity. It's repetitive, it's based on the past, it's fear-based, right? So when you achieve this ability to just watch your mind and not get pulled away by the mind activity, you begin achieving that witness position much more naturally. And when you're living as the witness of your life, life just becomes very simple, much, much easier, much happier, much lighter. The pressure that you normally feel living as an ego gets lifted. And you're like, I'm not here to like do anything great or accomplish some great task. I'm just here already as an extension of God. So whatever God wants to do through me is what God will do through me, and it's going to be perfect. And I'm just here to be in full cooperation. Much, much more burdenless way to live your life, right? Nothing sticks to you anymore, whether pleasurable or painful. You're just as happy as someone sitting on a couch watching a beautiful movie, right? When you're watching a movie, you're invested in the movie in the sense that you're observing it, you're enjoying it, you're watching it unfold. But as the witness, you have no ability to get attached or harmed by what appears on that movie screen. That's the state of inner stillness, right? Stillness is not this reality-ignoring, thought-hating kind of state. There's no rejection at all of any part of reality when you're in stillness, even thoughts. You're not rejecting thoughts. You're just identifying what thoughts are useful to you and what thoughts are not useful to you. Because if your goal is to be aware of love's presence at all times, which is the devotee's only goal, then it's very useful to that goal to watch your mind activity and say, oh, that's an unloving thought, therefore it's not useful to me. And I promise you guys, it's just that simple identifying of what thoughts are based in love and what thoughts are not, what thoughts are useful, what thoughts are not useful. It's just the ability to discern that and that activity going on in your mind of like noticing when you're straying away from useful thinking, thinking thoughts of love, thinking thoughts of how to be of service, what's practically useful to my life, anything outside of that. You need to develop this habit of being able to start noticing those thoughts and saying, ah, these thoughts are not useful. They take me away from presence. They take me away from stillness. Not interested. I'm only interested in abiding in the awareness of love's presence. So this is the practice for, let's call it detachment. Detachment from egoic desire, detachment from the burdens and the stresses of life, detachment from thought activity. This can be done in that simple way I just described of just being mindful, or it can be done in a much more radical way by taking certain practice periods during your day, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, and just spend those five or 10 minutes allowing every single impression, every sense impression, what you're hearing, what you're tasting, what you're smelling, what you're touching, and thought activity. Just watch every single impression you can be aware of and allow yourself to have the recognition, this is all a dream. Like, this too is just a dream. This feeling of drinking cold water, ah, delicious water, it's just a dream. It's all dream appearances happening in the mind. I'm the witness only. And to begin exploring your reality as a dream, rather than this physically, tangibly real, hard, dense matter that's really there, that begins to quiet the mind down. And this is why these three things that we're talking about today are very helpful for cultivating stillness, because they take away the tasks of the mind. The mind is always busy, right? The egoic mind, always busy, full of tasks, full of burdens it's trying to get rid of, full of outcomes it's trying to chase. It's got to do all day long. And so when you practice these three different qualities, basically all you're doing is you're removing one more thing from the mind's plate. Meaning, if I'm just witnessing my life unfold like a dream would unfold, then I'm giving the ego mind less to do. It doesn't have to go interact with that dream anymore now that it knows it's a dream. So again, this is not a denial of reality, and I very much am inwardly averse to those kinds of teachings, the Neo-Advaita teachings that are like, ignore everything, dismiss it, it's not real, it's an illusion. No. I don't ascribe to that. The world is not an illusion. What you think about it's an illusion. The way your mind pictures it as separate from you is an illusion. The world itself and every appearance in it is the divine presence appearing as a bird, as a person, as a car, as water, as everything, right? It's all God appearing and nothing else exists. So we're not dismissing physical reality as bad, unacceptable, invalid, illusory. We're dismissing our mind's interpretation of it as illusory. Are you guys rocking with that distinction? Does that make sense? It's a big distinction. I'm not dismissing the physical universe itself, or whatever you want to call it. I'm not dismissing the outer world itself. I'm dismissing everything my mind has to say about it. Because what it really is the divine presence itself. And if I want to experience that divine presence in the bird, in the person, in anything, then I have to be open in that way. I have to go beyond my mind's limited way of thinking about it. So that's why we're just paying attention to thoughts during the day and saying, is this, thinking about this, really useful to me? Is this contributing to my devotion to love? And if the answer is no, then you just let it go. And that's where the practice becomes very easy, because your mind will try to come up with a fear-based reason why you should think about it. So, you know, you're thinking about a conflict you had with a friend and it keeps coming up and you're like, do I need to be thinking about this conflict with my friend a few days ago? And the ego will say, oh, yes, you do. You better believe you do. Because if you don't think about it, you're not going to be able to solve it. And your friend's going to distance themselves. You're going to lose that friendship. And you're going to feel more lonely. And it will spiral into negative fear-based thinking. And that's your dead giveaway. Ah, there's a fear-based reason to think about this. Well, then it's definitely a useless thought. If it's based in fear, it's definitely a redundant, repetitive, unhelpful thought. Nothing based in fear has any use to me at all. Because I'm not a devotee of fear, I'm a devotee of love. And perfect love casts out fear, yeah? So I'm gonna share my screen and read a quote to you from the Ashtavakra Gita. In the Ashtavakra Gita, it says, love your true self, which is naturally happy and peaceful and bright. Awaken to your own nature, and all delusion melts like a dream. How much pleasure you take in acquiring worldly goods, but to find happiness, you must give them all up. The sorrows of duty, like the heat of the sun, have scorched your heart. But let stillness fall on you with its sweet and cooling showers, and you will find happiness. So clearly here, Ashtavakra is describing the way that the desires for worldly goods, for pleasure in the world, our attachments, the outcomes we think we want, these lead to sorrows, right? These lead to burdens and stresses. All we're doing is lumping burdens on top of the mind that it has to think about, it has to stress about, it has to put lots of effort to chase after. And so it takes us out of stillness when we're attached to these things. So Ashtavakra says, to find happiness, you must give them all up. So in one sense, it's like, yeah, that's as simple as it is. Practice giving up attachments. Is that always going to feel like an easy practice? By no means. But it gets easier the more you practice it. So moving on to the second point of mindfulness, of mindfulness of thought activity as a practice, we can say that part of devotion, the direct path, if you're going to abide in the awareness of love's presence, stillness is the gateway, right? Stillness is the entryway to be aware of love, because love is still, love is gentle, love is omnipresent. It doesn't force itself, it doesn't announce itself with a red carpet entrance. Love is very humble, right? It doesn't seek its own glory. So if you're going to be aware of the presence of love, you better get still, or you're never going to be aware of it, because the ego is always announcing its own presence. The ego is always rolling out the red carpet for its thoughts. And look at these thoughts. They're so important. They're way more important than anything else you could do right now. Worry about this. Worry about that. And so love's presence becomes obscure to you. So part of devotion is the continuous remembrance to abide in stillness, right? Under all circumstances, we should remember to be still inside, so that love's presence can not only be felt by us, but acted through us. And whenever we forget stillness and go back into mind activity, which will happen over and over, especially at the beginning, no problem at all, right? That's our chance to requalify. So we just have to simply notice our failure to abide in stillness and make the instant correction. Remember stillness again, return back to the simple being. Not striving, not struggling, not worrying, not stressing, just being. And if you really think about what the action, or the, it's not an action, but the state, let's say, of stillness implies to the universe, when you become still inside and you practice being still inside, what are you demonstrating to the universe? You're demonstrating that you have full trust in the divine will, in the divine power. When you live from a place of stillness, of surrender, acceptance, these qualities are powerful demonstrations to the universe that you're ready to ascend, and that you're cultivating the platform for fourth density consciousness to come and rest upon inside yourself, right? You're making room for love. You're making room for fourth density consciousness, and you're literally swearing your allegiance to the divine power when you are still. When you're busy and stressed out and going from this task to that task, which is very easy to do in our society, what are your actions and what is your state of being demonstrating to the universe then? It's demonstrating that you don't trust very much in the divine power because you're super stressed out, right? You're not so sure the divine power is gonna handle this one this time. Maybe the divine power's fallen asleep on the job today and I gotta go make up for the slack that God is leaving in God's universe, right? And that's personal doership, of course, which is the third one we're gonna get to. But so the feeling for this inner stillness has to be persistently nurtured, right? First brought in by daily practice. You know, as a devotee of God, I must first begin with the foundation of stillness. So maybe before I try to be aware of love's presence all the time, I should practice remembering to be still and let that become more natural to me. And then when I'm more still inside, being able to connect with the awareness of God's presence in me, surrounding me in this moment is much, much easier. It's less frustrating. I don't beat myself up so much. So, you know, you're doing yourself a lot of favors when you prioritize stillness. I always like to use the analogy of like a baseball pitcher who's trying to get to the major leagues. This applies to any sport, right, or any true discipline, but especially like pitching, for example. You've got to drill those basics over and over and over, right? If you want to learn how to throw a really good changeup or a curveball, well, you better have practiced your starting position a lot first, and you better have practiced your delivery first and your hip rotation and those basic mechanics of throwing a ball before you can get all nuancy and intricate with fancy pitches. Can you just throw a ball mechanically right? You know, that's what stillness is like. We want to experience the high level stuff, the being drowned in bliss all day and experiencing love's presence all day. We want that so bad, but a lot of times we feel like it's really difficult and we just can't stay there. We can't connect to that. Why? Well, we haven't really mastered the basics yet. If you want to connect to the presence, the omnipresence of love, you got to first have that foundation of stillness there. And so the devotee of God does themselves a great favor when they say, okay, God, I have devoted my life from this point forward to being your devotee. I live not for myself, but only for you, O Lord. And so because I want to live for you, I'm going to spend this entire year, 1 year of my life, I will dedicate radically to cultivating stillness of mind, so that I can become a true living altar for the divine to rest upon. I want to make myself a fitful dwelling place for God's presence. And a noisy mind full of anxious thoughts, full of lustful thoughts, full of jealous, angry, resentful thoughts, that kind of a mind isn't a ripe habitation for that presence of love, is it? All of those thoughts are contradictions of love. And so stillness would be the preliminary thing to do, wouldn't it? So in this way of mindfulness of thoughts, I'm gonna give you two practices actually, a bonus practice here. The first practice is just asking yourself the simple question, do I need to think about this right now? Is this thought truly useful to me right now? And that's what I mentioned at the beginning of just the basic mindfulness of, is this thought practically useful? Or useful for my goal of devotion? Or is it redundant, repetitive, unhelpful, fear-based, etc.? And just making that distinction is really all that needs to be done to cultivate more stillness. Mindfulness, as the Buddha called it, is one of the greatest devices for cultivating stillness, because as you recognize those unhelpful thoughts, it's the nature of a mistake to be corrected once it's recognized, yeah? Once you recognize that there's a mistake, instantly you start trying to correct that mistake. It's just natural. So when you recognize thoughts as unhelpful, not useful, there's a natural, not necessarily a repugnancy or something, but just a natural disinterest, right? You just see it as not useful. So getting in the habit of asking yourself that question when you notice you're in any other state than inner peace, right? If your state of being contracts at all, check in with what your mind's thinking about and say, is this useful to think about? Am I benefiting my spiritual growth by dwelling on this thought? And just asking the question will reveal the answer. But here's your bonus practice. And this one is very, very powerful. This practice will do wonders for your ability to cultivate inner stillness. But it's an admittedly challenging practice. And that is, when you're in conversation with someone, be very, very mindful of how much your ego wants to talk and how much you're not really listening to what they're saying, but thinking about what you want to say. And there's some space for that. It's okay to think about how you want to articulate what you want to say next. But we tend to do this obsessively, right? To where we're really not, we're maybe listening to like 20% of what somebody's saying and thinking about what we want to say next. And watch the ego's habit of being very quick to respond to someone and deliberately interject space in every conversation you're having, whether it's with your mom, whether it's with your best friend, whether it's with a stranger, whether it's with your romantic partner, your child. Do your best to be mindful of how quick you respond and how quick you are to think about what you want to say versus to truly listen and be fully present with someone. I promise you, although the ego says, I can't let there be space between what they say and between what I say, they'll get offended. But I promise you the opposite's the case, that when you're truly listening to someone, when they have your full undivided attention and presence, listening is loving, right? Listening to someone is one of the most loving things you can do for them. So when someone feels that you're truly listening and present, and you take, 3 to 5 seconds before you come up with your response, they'll be very appreciative of it because they're like, wow, this person's really engaged with what I'm saying. And what you're doing is you're creating more of a buffer between those automatic gears of the mind that want to spit out a response right away. Immediately say this, hold on, let's leave some space to let what they said be acknowledged. And then I'll say what comes to my mind and heart to say. And then when I'm done speaking, I'm fully listening again. Conversation with other people, as A Course in Miracles says, right? Other people really are one of the greatest, if not the greatest, catalysts for spiritual growth. So take advantage of your time with others and watch how your mind is quick to try to say something to get them to approve of you or laugh at you or give you attention, and reverse it and say, no, I'm here to give them my attention. They can give me whatever attention they want. That's none of my business. I'm here to give them my attention because that's loving. And I'm going to pay deep attention to what they're saying, leave some space, and then say what I have to say. Let them hear it and let them respond. And then there's this giving and receiving. There's more space in the conversation. It's okay to take time to think about what you want to say, right? These things are very good for cultivating stillness. Because one of the ways we spin up the ego mind is in conversation, when it's just this constant back and forth, a constant thinking about what I want to say next. That gives more energy and inertia to the thinking mind, right? So in that same way, we can reverse that and use conversation with others not to stir up the mind, but to slow down the mind, to invite more presence in conversation. And can't we all be honest? Wouldn't we all say that this is true? That the best conversations we have in life are those conversations when we're with someone and we're both deeply in a space of contemplation together, and there's more space in the conversation, and they share their heart and you're deeply listening, and then you respond and share your heart, and there's not this rushing going on, but there's this space. It's like you're comfortable with each other. You don't need to fill the silence all the time with noise. Those are always the most wonderful conversations to enjoy. And everybody feels heard, right? So that's the two practices I'll give you for mindfulness, cultivating mindfulness around your thought activity. And let's pull up another Ashtavakra quote here. It says, the master goes about his business with perfect equanimity. He is happy when he sits, happy when he talks and eats, happy asleep, happy coming and going. Because he knows his own nature, he does what he has to without feeling ruffled like ordinary people. Smooth and shining, like the surface of a vast lake, his sorrows are at an end. The fool is busy even when he is still. Even when he is busy, the master is still. Isn't that a great quote? Beautiful distinction there. I especially love happy when he sits, happy when he talks, eats, happy when asleep, happy when coming and going, because he knows his own nature. He does what he has to do without feeling ruffled like ordinary people. Meaning, again, the state of inner silence is not some state of inert inactivity. You're not just sitting blankly staring at a wall all day. You can be very dynamic. You can be running businesses. You can be having dynamic relationships. You can be snowboarding down a mountain in great inner silence. In fact, everything in life is greatly enhanced in the state of silence because the state of inner silence cultivates the flow state. Right, the flow state is a state of inner stillness, inner alertness, and mindfulness and presence, right? You can't be in a flow state and be thinking about stuff at the same time. So when we live from silence, from inner stillness, we're actually living from flow. And the flow state is the third eye state of mastery on the SQ chart. The master, as it says in the Ashtavakra Gita, is one who's living in that state. They're constantly in a flow state, as if, you know, a great pool player who's playing a game of pool in a flow state, nailing every single shot, total silence of mind, complete focus and attention on what they're doing, and they just can't miss a shot. Well, the master is in that state all the time in every endeavor, not just in a hobby or something they're good at, right? They've practiced the state itself and are able to translate that state to anything they're doing. So, speaking of flow, let's move to the third and final segment of non-doership. When we start practicing this kind of mindfulness of thoughts, it will also translate to actions. Meaning, if you get really good at watching your mind, you'll just naturally start watching your body's actions as well. It's an immediate translation because, in a sense, all bodily actions come from thought, whether past thought or present thought. Our actions are always kind of acting out our thinking, right? And so in watching your mind, you can also watch the body with the same mindfulness and say, what is my body doing right now? What is my body? What are the actions of my body communicating about my state of being? What are my emotions feeling in this moment? Because the moment that we attempt to do anything to fix ourselves or improve ourselves, as we talked about a few weeks ago, the moment I try to improve myself with my own effort, I introduce the ego again, the personal doer. And being a personal doer of your actions, rather than being lived by the power of life, that gives the mind a lot to think about, doesn't it? If you, as an isolated character, separate from the divine power, have to choose all your actions and try to figure out what the best action is and what the worst action is and do those good actions and don't do those bad actions, boy, that's a lot of pressure to put on the mind, right? You're going to have a very, very busy mind if you're the personal doer, if you're in control of everything. But the non-doer is not in control of life. They're in cooperation with life, right? The non-doer never attempts to control life because non-doership is like dancing with life, right? Non-doership can be likened to the analogy of a classic dance partnership of male and female. In classic dancing, whether it's ballroom or swing dancing, it's always that there's a coordination going on between male and female positions, right? Both are equally needed or no dance can happen. And that is, the male position is the leader of the dance, initiating the movements. The female position is the receiver of that movement and the follower of that movement. And if both aren't doing their job, the dance gets interrupted, right? There can't be that coordination. So in that sense, when we're living from non-doership, we're sort of taking the female position in a dance, and the divine power God, the universe, love, is taking the male position. So it's not that we're not acting. There is much action going on. It's that from what position are we acting from? Are we trying to be the leader, or are we being the follower? Are we in cooperation or in control? And whenever we suffer, it's because we're like the female trying to take control of the dance. And the female tries to initiate the movements. And the male's like, well, hey, that's my job. So what am I supposed to do now? Right? You're kind of kicking the male position out. And so life becomes disharmonious. And we invite negative karma every time we try to control life. So that's non-doership, right? It's not to say that no actions happen. It is to say, I only do what I see my Father doing, as Jesus said. I have no motive of my own, right? There's no personal will here. I need to go get fame and fortune and all these things. I have no will of my own other than to live in perfect obedience to the light, perfect cooperation with love's presence. I'm just following what love is doing. I'm just doing what love is doing through me because I'm still, I'm listening, I'm receptive. As we said in the beginning, silence is the state of listening. And when you're listening, that's akin to watching, right? As the female watches what movements her male partner initiates and she cooperates with them, they perform a ravishing visual dance that's dazzling to behold. We watch spellbound, wow. But if we watch a dance where male and female are competing for control, we go, I think they need some more practice. And that's how we live, right? When we're trying to control life. So there's an analogy for you to understand non-doership through. It's a dance of cooperation, right? By abiding in stillness, we surrender the ego's need to control. We surrender the ego's personal actions and imply now that we're willing to be guided by love. And so love begins to guide our actions when we make room for it. If you make room for love, love will act through you. If you make a home for love to dwell, love will dwell in you. And it will be love's actions that come through you. It will be love's thoughts that come into the mind. It will be love's feelings that are felt in the body, if you can make room for it. And we make room for it by cultivating stillness, getting rid of these notions that I'm the doer of actions and it's all my job to control, to think, to do. I've got to conquer life. That's the best way possible to spin the mind up with busyness, right? So the practice of non-doership, to summarize, practice watching your actions just like you would watch your thoughts, you know, mindfulness of my actions as well, because your actions are telling you a lot, right? There's a lot of information to be picked up in the way my body's acting. But here's the key of the practice, and I hope you guys can get this. Whatever God does is naturally loving and harmonious. The divine power, when left to itself without negative infringement, when the divine power is left by itself, it is naturally harmonious, creative, connected, loving, embracing, accepting. So when any good action is done through the body, any action that is of service, is loving, is kind, is beneficial, any action that makes you feel positive, immediately say, look what God is doing through the body. Look at the way God is acting through me. And don't take any personal credit for a virtuous action. Don't let the ego take personal credit for loving actions. Say, wow, look at the divine power acting through me, being loving to everyone. And that's a way to give up the personal credit ego likes to take for righteous actions, to inflate itself and feel self-righteous. Wow, look how kind I am. I'm so loving. I'm so of service. Be careful not to let the ego hijack those things and instead take no personal credit, as Jesus did. Of myself, I can do nothing. Why do you call me good? No one's good but God alone, yet I and my Father are one. So that's what we do with positive actions, is we say, look what God is doing through me. Beautiful. I love being lived by the divine power. And then on the other hand, any actions that are disharmonious, that are negative, that are selfish, that are fear-based, are always the ego's actions trying to wrestle control away from God, from life, from reality. And so any action like that, any negatively oriented action at all, You should say right away, wow, look at the ego trying to act through me. Look at the ego trying to act apart from God right now. And rightly identify it. That's the discrimination, right? Loving actions is the God power acting through me. Unloving actions is the ego trying to hijack that power for itself, to act separately from God. And so you just watch it. You notice it when it happens. When you practice identifying loving, positive actions as God's actions, and then you identify selfish negative actions as the ego's actions, you create an easy dichotomy in your awareness to stay in that flow state, to stay as the non-doer, to stay in cooperation with God. Because I cannot cooperate with God, I cannot cooperate with life if I'm being selfish and unloving. That's me trying to take control of the leader position in the dance, right? Life is the dancer. You're the dance. You're being danced by life. You're not the one deciding how life should go. So remain in that position by watching your actions and saying, oh, that was ego. Oh, there's God acting through me. Because it's only one or the other, right? Just like A Course in Miracles says, there's just two thought systems, nothing else. There's the ego's thought system and there's God's thought system. In the ego's thought system, you always act in resistance to life. You always try to control life to get some personal will accomplished. But in surrender, you always act with God, and the divine power overshadows you with its mighty wings, and synchronicities unfold themselves. You're led, you're guided exactly where you need to go as you stay in surrender, stay in trust. It's not I who does the works, but my Father in heaven. I'm just a devotee. I'm just a servant of the Most High. And you remain in that humble position. Humility is inner silence. Humility is stillness. And there's nothing more arrogant, ultimately, than being the personal doer. To think that you have some kind of separate individual control apart from God's power. Right? You're a second power in the universe. That's the ultimate arrogance, isn't it? So that has to be given up over time, but it's very subtle. It's kind of hard to see. We're used to that default operating mode. So we have to practice awareness of the body's actions in this way. So we'll close with this, these final few quotes from the Ashtavakra. Celebrated, he is not delighted. Spurned, he is not angry. Pure of heart, he watches his own actions as if they were another's. How can praise or blame disturb him? So that's an interesting one, right? Celebrated, he is not delighted. Well, come on, Aaron, are you saying I shouldn't enjoy when people are nice to me or give me praise? No, I'm not saying you shouldn't enjoy it. What this quote is saying is that you're not attached to that praise or celebration, right? In the state of stillness, in non-doership, everything's accepted equally. So praise is accepted from a neutral place. If someone says a kind word to you, it doesn't land on the ego and inflate your sense of pride, right? You just say, oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate that. It doesn't cling to you, right? You're not identifying with it in any way. You're not using it to enhance your sense of self. You're just grateful, just accepting like anything else. And then if you can do that with celebration, you can do it with scorn as well. If someone's critical of you, if you practice not attaching to praise, then you won't also be offended or hurt by scorn. You're equally detached, right? You're pure of heart, as it says here, because you're watching your own actions no differently than as if they were someone else's actions. Another great description there of non-doership. This one I love as well. You've probably heard me quote this one. It is because of effort that everyone is unhappy, but nobody knows that. It is with this superior teaching that the blessed ones attain liberation. Happiness belongs only to the greatly lazy person who considers even blinking his eyelashes a wearisome exertion. Only he is happy, no one else. So a pretty dramatic description there from Ashtavakra to make an important point, which is the effort, the personal doership type effort. Blinking the eyelashes is going on all the time. It's an automatic thing we don't think much about. But to a true master who's living from that state of non-doership, of dancing with life, being lived by life, even to take personal control over a blink is too much energy. And that's what's implied by the laziness. It's, I like to call it divine laziness. Because it's like, man, God is in such absolute, radical, and total control of God's universe. What the hell am I going to do? What the hell can I add to this perfect universe already? There's literally nothing to do. It's all already perfect. It's all already unfolding under the divine will. So there's literally nothing for me to do. Just to be present, just to be in the dance, in the cooperation of that perfect universe that is already here. You know, that's what the state of the true master feels like.